On the line from Tutukaka in Northland, here in New Zealand, I have Wade Doak, who is New Zealand's equivalent to Jacques Cousteau, having spent over 50 years as an aquanaut around New Zealand's coastline, interacting underwater with all species and researching the local ocean ecosystems, especially where the land meets the sea and the diverse interactions in these environments. Wade is a world authority on dolphins and has travelled extensively overseas, sharing his knowledge on these most intelligent of creatures. Yet his knowingness on so many levels as to how the ocean systems work and the biota that inhabit them and the need to lock away more areas as reserves and sanctuaries is now an important issue that Wade speaks passionately for. As we gain a greater knowing that our planet is a gigantic living supersystem that connects all biota into a complex web of life, what are we going to leave future generations is foremost on his mind, as it is becoming for more and more people on this planet today. So, kia ora, Wade, and good morning and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Tim, and pleased to be with you.
Wade, let's start with some of the wonder that has touched you in this life. What are some of the truly magical moments of meeting sort of charismatic megafauna and times when you openly experienced joy and marveled about the water world that you visited?
That's a big question, because there's just so many highs. I'll dip into it in a sort of random way. I'll never forget the day that I was at a whale conference, an international whale conference in Boston, America, and they decided to take everyone from the conference out to sea in a specially designed whale-watching vessel. And there were about 150 people, all the Illuminati of the conference, Sir Peter Scott, Walter Cronkite, John Lilly, and I thought this dooley squad of a chance to see whales. Jen and I had been researching whales with our own catamaran for 15 years, and we'd had our own lovely interactions with them, just Jen, myself, the catamaran, and the whales. But to go out on a big ship like that with all those people, I thought the chances were zilch. Anyway, we went out onto an area off Boston called the Stellwagen Bank, and that's a very fishy place, lots and lots of small fish all over the bank. And we hadn't been there for very long when there was a hail from the bridge, whales out on the starboard beam, and everyone's eyes swirled over there, and lo and behold, there was two humpback whales feeding there on small fish. And I thought, okay, they're having a feed. This is it. We've seen some whales. What a great day. But those whales had been visited by the whale-watching boats frequently. There's a context to this. Scientists went out on each whale-watching boat, and they kept a very good record of all the whales. They had a code, a filing system, which could quickly tell you the details of the whales, who they were, when they were born, everything about them. And if anybody ever saw one that wasn't on the file, they could name it and adopt it. So the whales raised their heads slightly and then vanished under the water, and then I became aware they were heading our way. Well, this boat was specially designed for whale watchers, and 150 people standing along the rail on one side didn't tip it over. The whales came in on the beam side of the ship and then under the keel, and something told me, I've been out on boats a fair bit, go to the other side. They came up, one on midships and one on the stern quarter, and eyeballed everybody. And it was perhaps a more religious experience than I would ever have had in my life, that for the rest of the day, everybody was different towards each other, and they couldn't get rid of the grins off their faces. But those whales then put on a performance of leaps, of a balletic sort of leaps from the sea, which the scientists have to now accept in the context of them doing it around the whale-watching boats so frequently, that it's some sort of response to their sense of the immense awe and reverence and admiration that came from those people on the whale-watching boat. So that was one of those occasions when I felt goose flesh all over. And even as I tell it to you now, I'm getting goose flesh.
So it's a great contact high. Do you feel that just the combined energy of everybody on the boat coalesced into one energy form that the whales instantly picked up and you just built on it?
There is something like that. There's things that we can't really put in words, Tim, but the magnificence of whales is such that people that have been touched by them get huge energy, and we can see this all over the world in the movements towards protecting the whales. If you are hunting them, you won't feel that energy. I've actually met the Japanese whalers. I've met them. I've had breakfast with them in Washington, D.C., and I've had dinner with them in San Francisco. I will not regard any human beings as my enemy. That's absurd. I just want to communicate with them. I want to listen to their stories and tell them ours. Somewhere along the line, I'm hopeful that there will be an end to the killing of whales, and we'll all experience that incredible joy that's there for us if we treat them as fellow beings on our planet. And when it comes to the blue whale, the size of a jumbo jet, you could put two decks inside a blue whale. Even at the flukes or tail, it's still 8 feet in diameter. I've actually had a dream of seeing every city have a great big fiberglass scale model of a blue whale, which we'd be able to visit up a spiral staircase through the umbilical, go up and see a circular television set in the eye, which would be showing you deep underneath the sea, while you're listening to the sounds of the blue whale, that huge rumble that can go 400 miles to the next whale. And the whole interior of the blue whale would be telling us the story of the whale's life and sort of a museum, because the blue whale represents the absolute apex of life as we know it in this universe. Nothing has ever reached such a scale, and from all accounts, never has a blue whale shown other than curiosity and gentleness towards our species.
Do you feel that we need to possibly, sometime in the very near future, look at giving them certain human rights, particularly we start, say, with the blue whales and then start building on it?
Yes, that is a concept that's been around for quite a long time now. We made that much progress visibly, but maybe it's sort of creeping around the world and will manifest eventually. I think it will be something we'll have to extend as much to other terrestrial animals too. And we got to have to make a lot of ethical decisions, but there's also a very strong movement to protect all the great apes and give them the same rights of citizenship on the planet as ourselves. Part of the problem, as I see it, is that when we're born, we see the whole world from our bassinet. It centres on us. And as a species, that's been our history too. We thought that Earth was the centre of the universe and everything rotated around us. So that's an anthropocentric view of the universe. And we're getting away from it slowly over hundreds of years since Copernicus and Galileo made their little glass lens telescopes and looked out into the universe and told us a story which got them into so much trouble with the establishment. Their lives were at risk. We're slowly growing up as a species. And the big, big challenge for us is to reach a point of maturity where we can see ourselves as not top dog, the purpose of life not being us, but as part of a whole huge complex interrelating mosaic of life, which I find far more exciting and stimulating way of looking at life than seeing ourselves as lonely little bare fork creatures, as Shakespeare called us.
So in spending much of your life submerged underwater, Wade, you'll have seen and experienced some very profound situations that show how remarkable nature is, of course, but especially as we realise the urgency of sustainability. Can you relate to some of the needs that we need to grow up to understand as a humanity?
Well, you've made me think with that question of a very odd, special moment in my life when I visited an atoll right on the equator called Roncador Reef. It's a young atoll. It hasn't reached the point where it's emerged from the ocean with coconut trees yet. It's just a coral moat on top of a volcano. And I was there at that blessed moment when the tide stabilized. There was no tide coming in and no tide going out. And I was in the mouth of the pass where all the water that flowed into the lagoon had to come and go. And there I saw corals and sponges and all the reef life developed by the flow of water. Everything was just absolutely mega, huge. And it was like being at the intersection in Queen Street, 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning. everything had stopped. Everything was still. The sharks there were just swimming around lazily, all the fishes right under their nose, no feeding. And for a little split second in time, I saw the whole life of a thriving coral community in very, very clear water. And then, just next door, I had the most inspiring experience. Met a village full of people who are basically the same people as the Maori people. Coming there was just like coming home. Felt so at one with those people. But from them I learned something that's really exciting for me. It gives me huge hope in our future. Those people had come there 800 years earlier, and they had, living on an atoll, which is very difficult to survive on, it's just a big sand cay, they had a sustainable lifestyle. They had plenty of everything. They were some of the few humans that I know of on Earth that have made it to the point that we've got to get to. They were sun, they were wind, their energy all came from natural sources, and they had plenty of fish. We studied all their fishing techniques to understand why they hadn't fished things out. So from those people, I thought, well, since Ed Hillary and Tenzin got to the top of Mount Everest, people are walking up there with artificial legs. Blind people have been to the top of Mount Everest. The mountain's still as high as it was when they struggled up there. So if a few of our species can make it, maybe we could all do it too.
Very good. And these people on the island, of course, growth was not an important issue, where you have to continually have to expand. They've thought it all out and realized that they don't need to have a lot of plastic and all the other toys, or if they do, they make sure that they take care of recycling them or getting rid of them in a conscious way?
Well, for most of that 800 years, they were cut off from the Western world. But the Western world has impacted on them now. Because elsewhere in the Solomon Islands, loggers have come in and cut down the rainforest, they no longer get drift logs coming over the ocean to their atoll. They relied on those drift logs for their outrigger canoes. So I've been to this atoll twice in a 20-year period. The first time I went, it was when I was inspired, because they had outrigger canoes, and that was sustainable. But the impact of the Western world 300 miles away on the high islands dried up the supply of logs, and they had no alternative then but to buy fiberglass canoes with outboards. And to sustain that, they had to dive for sea cucumbers and sell them to the Asian market. So now they're part of the money economy using products derived from oil. In other words, there's nowhere on the planet where you can really hold out from our global economic system that everyone gets embroiled in it sooner or later. And so basically, while I'm inspired by the example that they showed of hundreds of years of sustainability, I think now we've all got to fall into line and take the steps towards reaching that goal as a planet-wide citizenry.
We certainly do. And Wade, here in New Zealand, of course, you're walking on the shoreline, and then when you look to the land behind you, you see what's happening on the land, and then when you turn around and look to the sea and go deep in underneath the sea, you're seeing a huge change in what's been washed off the land. Can you explain the challenges here for us to really acknowledge what it's all like with the rivers that carry debris now into the oceans and the life that does its best, and with fish going up into the freshwater of the rivers that are now in the estuaries? There's huge problems coming into being now, is there not?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because just yesterday I spent an hour and a half filming underwater in the estuary near where I live at Nungaroo. There's a lovely big mangrove estuary. And it's just representative of so many river systems in New Zealand, and it's on my doorstep. So I've made a very intensive study of it, as well as looking at many other estuaries between Auckland and the north. And yesterday, I'll tell you a little story. I was diving on a little rock outcrop down near the lower part of the estuary, and I found a population of grasses that we call spotties, and they are absolutely abounding. Just like on a coral reef, so many little fishes, along with the invers, three species of blennies. If I put my hand down, I was pecked by so many blennies because they are territorial and they don't want anything, even a hand, invading their world. I spent 90 minutes filming their world. I filmed so many aspects of it. There was an octopus amongst them. He was very cooperative. But these spotties represent a thriving community. There's a story to the spotty. Every spotty starts life as a female. Amongst all those hundreds of females, there's one lucky male. He had the whole, all those girls to himself. The only thing is that he used to be the top girl in the group. If anything happened to the male, that females would undergo a hormone change, the top female would become a male in 2 weeks. Now, that's actually very much like our own society. We use the same hormones as the spotties, and I think we respond to them in the same ways. So here we have all these different species of fishes with their complex little tribal lives, all intermingling, all involved with each other, and I'm trying to present it in a film because I want to say this is what's at stake when in the winter time the river becomes a sea of mud. You can't see an inch in that river because all around in the catchment there's huge amounts of clay coming away from the hillsides. We've got four big pine forestry operations going here, which Jen and I have explored and documented intensively, because we're so concerned. We've been diving in this area since 1963, and we can see the decline in life. We can see the effect of this sediment. Eventually, some systems, if they get too much sediment, they just collapse and there's nothing there. Or they can become, their immunity is damaged and they get affected by disease, which has happened at the Whangateo estuary nearer to Auckland. So this responsibility we feel as old-time divers that have seen half a century of the life in the sea really pushes our button. We've really got to try and tell this story because all over the world, the soils that we exploit for our food production are sliding into the sea. The irony of that is the same time as we take away from the productivity of the land, we're destroying the productivity of the ocean. It's a lose-lose thing. So turning that around, if we fix it, then it'll be a win-win. And we've got to fix it.
We need to, of course, enact laws, but it's education and making people more aware. How do we do this?
Well, it's actually quite easy. Jen and I have lived like this on our own, and we've got 40 acres of rainforest here, and we've learnt that we've made mistakes. We've recognised them, we've corrected them, we've done huge amounts of pest control. We've now got total forest canopy over the whole lot, and we've got all our fruit trees and gardens and things like that in amongst it. Because I think it is possible for humans to live as part of nature. And all around me I can see this is happening spontaneously all through Northland, and I think in many parts of New Zealand and in other parts of the world too, that people have seen where are we going if we carry on the way our society's global society has been going. And they're pulling back. In thousands of clearings all over this planet, people are finding an alternative way. There's things like the transition town movement. There's a meeting of that on the 11th in Whangarei. It's a marvellous thing. But we go back to the previous oil shock, Jen and I. We go back to the 70s. That's when we decided to set ourselves up on a piece of land and start living in the future now.
I agree. And what about locking away areas for fish sanctuaries?
Well, we've already got some wonderful land sanctuaries. Jen and I have been to quite a few of the predator-proof fenced areas. We've been fortunate to be able to go to Tiri Island and the Little Barrier. And it's just such an absolute inspiration to see what New Zealand used to be like when we were Gondwana land. We were one of the most magic parts of the world. And we can fix it. We can put it back. And in the sea, we've seen a tremendous decline in the time that I've been diving. From the time I've made my first diving helmet and walked around on the bottom in Littleton Harbour with two girls pumping air down for me for a car pump in relays, I've seen the ocean's life decline. I realize now that even back in the 50s, it was already pretty well whacked everywhere you could drive a car to, that it was heavily overfished even then. And then in the interval between 50s and now, I've seen the development where everybody's got a boat and the boats are getting bigger and bigger. And we now use skyrockets. We use spacecraft to catch fish. Because every time we put a satellite up with a rocket, that helps us to find reefs out there in the ocean that were once natural marine sanctuaries. Nothing new about marine sanctuaries. They've always been there, places that we couldn't find easily, places, pinnacles of rock out in the sea, where life was still burgeoning. But now, with the global position and finding systems, anyone can go out in their boat and fish everywhere. So there's no sanctuary for life unless we create these places. And I'm absolutely saddened at the fact that the success of marine reserves for the fishing community has not caught on. People that fish around marine reserves know damned well that those are the best places to go fishing, and no one that sets up marine reserves resents that, as long as we have sensible daily quotas and things like that. But the marine reserve is the sanctuary that's going to replace the fishes that we want to take, and the invertebrates, all the power, and the kinna, and the mussels. I've learnt a bit about them. They really have to be in a high density to make love. I likened it to getting together at Woodstock. And it's no use having a power 30 feet away from another power. They can't make love like that. In the old days, I used to see power like hubcaps all over the rocks, actually touching shells. So we need places where power and mussels and kinna and all those vertebrates we love to eat can actually be in those high densities. If you allow them to breed, they produce so many larvae that they will repopulate all the coast in between, and we can live in plenty. But if we don't have these seed trees in the sea, then we have a very grim future.
And pawa are abalone and kinna are sea eggs.
That's right, yes.
Of course, we've got Tarawhanui and Goat Island as marine sanctuaries. However, there has to be far more, hasn't there? We've really got to get serious. We had a professor down from Vancouver a couple of years ago who said that New Zealand needs to lock away up to one-third of its fishing grounds for a number of years to allow the fish to restock.
He's dead right. There's so many things we're doing wrong. Take this, for example. We still have fishing contests for the biggest fish, right? Now, nobody questions it, but I do, because if we had competitions for the best bull that you killed, or the best boar that you killed, or the best rooster, imagine where our farming would be. We know that those biggest animals, the ones that are most successful, provide the best genes, so we breed from them. What are we breeding from in the sea? Who thinks about this? We are breeding from all the less successful, smaller snapper. We catch the big snapper and stand proudly at the weigh-in at the same time as we're sawing the branch off, metaphorically, that we stand on for our fishing. We should have top size levels. We should leave all those big fish alone, but not create them as trophies, but look on them as pedigree animals. Stud, they're a stud that we need in the sea to provide the best genes. Now, that's just one of the aspects of our fishing that doom us to a very, very miserable future if we don't wake up to the biology of the fishes.
I have witnessed in the last 2 months many fish, 3.5 kilo, 4 kilo snapper, being pulled out, and they're all full of roe. And the fishermen just don't acknowledge that.
Yes, well, I mean, people in other parts of the world, third world people that live on atolls and that, they've developed these sort of processes of conservation because if they didn't, when we went there, there wouldn't be any people there. That suddenly hit us, that these people are the outcome of a selection process where they got it right, and where they got it wrong, they've eliminated themselves. There wasn't any foreign aid. There was no external source that helped them. So they're not smarter than us. in the sense that they got bigger brains or anything. They were just the result of the natural selection. Well, that same process is affecting us too, just taking a bit longer since we tapped into all those fossilized sun energy, which we call oil and coal. That's given us a huge boost beyond what they had with just their sun and their wind. But the same process is going to affect us too. And unless we respond to the natural laws that are around us, then we'll eliminate ourselves too.
I'm speaking with Wade Durrick, who is an underwater diver and researcher. And Wade, are you noticing any different fish coming into New Zealand waters? I've heard that walu, which is a Fijian fish, and mahi-mahi, which you also get in Hawaii and Tahiti, they're in our waters. Are our waters noticeably getting slightly warmer?
Well, it's very difficult to say because of the cycles of the El Nino and La Nina cycles, because for years now, I've seen the times when there'll be a great big influx of tropical fishes come into areas like the Poor Nights particularly, but even on the coast and other offshore islands. And then they'll decline and many of them will just vanish and then there'll be another wave. In the long time that I've been diving out there, I've seen multiple waves of exotics arriving. But the thing I've noticed is that each new wave brings the same ones that were here before, but always one or two new ones are coming that have not been seen before. So am I seeing a gradual change towards a new range of fishes establishing here? Well, unfortunately, our lives are too short to see the our hand of the marine world changing. And so I can't be sure. I can just say that's the indication that I've noticed. But those fishes that I've seen are not establishing themselves here. They're not breeding here. They arrive, but they don't survive the winters. So the answer to your question, the indication is yes, but we can't be sure. It'll take a longer period of time before you can make a firm answer.
Wade, could you describe just a little bit about the Poor Nights, which is a great marine sanctuary, an island group off the coast here? When you dive, it is basically like it was 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, with the amount of fish, walls and walls of fish. Is that correct?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that, Tim. When I started diving out at the Poor Nights in 1963 with Kelly Tarleton, we were avid spear fishermen in those days. But we were selective. We wanted to catch bigger and bigger fish. In other words, I'm a reformed criminal. We spent hours looking into the blue, waiting for a marlin to come along. We wanted to spear something bigger than anybody else. And in those days, by 1963, spearing of fish at the Nights had already been underway, and some of the most vulnerable species, like the beautiful bluefish or blue drummer, had almost been wiped out. I started to get much more interested in underwater photography than killing things when I saw that it was just a dead end. And I spent ages trying to get a picture of a snapper. For my first fish book, I've done four books on fish now. My first book, 1972, I had the best of gut to get a picture of a snapper. Well, what's happened since the total no-take marine reserve was established is that there are walls of snapper there now. The other day when I was out there, I saw a snapper schooling right up on the surface, just like blue mau mau do, and trevally. I'd never seen that in the past. Such an abundance of snapper that they were chasing the little pink krill. They had them against the wall of the island, against the surface, so there was no escape, and then they were just slurping them up. This is a very positive story I see now, that the scientists themselves are absolutely staggered. They never anticipated that the fish populations at the Poor Nights would respond so quickly to total protection. And of course, anyone that does a bit of thinking about it realizes that if you've got a big population of, a healthy population of fishes around a bunch of islands, that'll function just like one of those, a giant fishery attraction device, or FAD, which game fishermen like to set up by anchoring buoys out in deep water, because anything out in deep water attracts whole colony of fishes around it, and that's where they find their game fish. Well, look, I saw this some years ago. I realized that the Pornites was going to become a huge fisheries attraction device or fad. In other words, it would actually improve things for the fishermen. And I'm just amazed that any resistance they're having. I would think every fisherman in New Zealand would want to have a fad, an FAD, a fisheries attraction device, in the form of a marine reserve in the midst. I mean, it's a sensible, you can go fishing and you can put a bit of bait on your hook, but if you're clever, you put down some chum to bring the fish around. You mince up some fish heads with a mincer on the stern of your boat. The knowing fishermen all know about that.
Really?
So just as we chum fish to get them around us, why don't we set up protected areas? I'm surprised that the fishermen are not saying, well, when they're going to set one up for us. And another angle on it too, one that's dear to me, was the day I realised that the function of marine reserve is complex, and one of the functions is educational. The marine biologists of tomorrow are going to school right now. Some of them started just yesterday at primary school, you know? Now, what are those kids going to experience as future citizens of this planet if all they can see when they go to the edge of the tide is empty water? How can they possibly take on the job of managing our future? And so I see it that every school should have a marine reserve within daily travel of the school. It should be basically an amenity just like a library or a tennis court or a swimming pool. Every school knows what those basic amenities do for their kids. And I think that since we live on a planet where two-thirds of it is water, since New Zealanders live in the middle of a huge ocean, to have kids that are not familiar with a thriving community of our normal reef fish, but haven't really seen what it would be like to have a thriving kelp forest instead of just birch and sea urchin barrens, which you would see in most of the bays on northern coast nowadays, then we're failing them educationally. So I've called these, I feel every parent should be clamouring to have a wet library handy to the school for education of their children.
And we could have a stainless steel rod on every beach somewhere with measurements on it so that we can measure the tides, so that if ocean sea levels are building up, the children could note this and share it via the web to all other schools around the planet so that the children can actually see how the so-called tides are working, particularly if there's going to be an increase in water as a result of the ice in Antarctica and Greenland, etc., melting. So it's a whole living laboratory.
That's it. I mean, an awareness of the sea is such an important part of education. But I've come to another level of understanding, Tim. There was a day when I was walking in the forest with a scientist friend. We were frustrated because the sea was rough and we couldn't go out to the Pornites. We were walking around, it was winter time, and it must have been early spring, and I became aware of the little green hood orchids that were under my feet. I'd been standing on them until this day, and I suddenly noticed they reminded me of something from under the sea. And then I realized that they've got long petals that stick out like antennae. Now, there's a shrimp that lives in the sea called the coral shrimp, which has six long white antennae. It doesn't hide itself, it advertises itself, because all the fishes know that those white antennae are Red Cross signals. That's where you can get your sea lice removed from your gills and your fin pits, something that drives fish nuts. So they queue up to get their nits removed by the coral shrimp, and the little orchids were using the same device to attract insects to them. When an insect enters a green hood orchid, it stands on a really complex mechanism, a bit like the mechanism of a mousetrap, but doesn't kill the insect. It just pitches the insect forward mechanically until it can't help but get pollen on it. Really complicated little piece of bioengineering. So from that time, I started looking at the life in the forest and seeing the patterns of life under the sea repeated. Now, just a few weeks ago, I was doing a television interview for a Canadian television series which has a website too, One Planet. And David Suzuki is the man behind that, who's someone I think has a stature even greater than Al Gore. They had taken me out to one of my favourite places on the coast to interview me, and I was telling them a story. The great big camera that they lugged down me was grinding away, and the sound man was holding his fluffy microphone above my head, and the interviewer was asking me questions, and I told them that I discovered there's a little fish in the sea that no one thinks much about called a leather jacket that's so important because it bites every square inch of the bottom at least once a year and creates new places for other things to settle. And that's why there's such a crazy cool mosaic of life. If it wasn't for the little leather jacket or trigger fish, certain organisms would be dominant. Well, in the forest they discovered that that function was fulfilled by the wood pigeon. I was describing all that when there was a funny look on the interviewer's face and she took her breath. You know, at that moment, on the big kowhai tree behind me, two wood pigeons settled in camera and started to court each other. It's those magic moments sometimes I experience with nature that make me wonder just what really is going on. Because when I'm in the process of celebrating it, when I'm at that critical point of trying to get something across, I've often had something utterly magic happen like that. And that is documented. It's in the can. It's not just a story. It's over there, ready to go out over the world television systems. So it's magic documented.
Serendipity. It's profound, isn't it?
It happens, and sometimes you can prove it.
Yes, yes. Wade, in nature, there is no waste. A larger fish at the high end or the top end of the food chain, when it excretes or defecates, the next layer of fish underneath will come in and eat it. I remember meeting you many years ago, and you talked about snapper and stingrays. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Well, it's even more complicated now, Tim, but yes, there have been scientists that have just studied the whole pattern of defecation and where it goes and what everything does. Well, I found out that also that the old Maori men that have all gone now, they knew this. They knew that big snapper are followed about by the big bottlenose dolphins, and the bottlenose dolphins, when they defecate, the snapper eat it. But then, further down the track, when a stingray defecates, the snapper actually swim underneath it and wait for it to release and gobble it up. When Kelly Tarleton and I went up to the Three Kings to get the Elingamite treasure in 1969, we couldn't charter any boat that had normal facilities in those days, so we had no toilets. And we found that the trevally ate everything, which put me off trevally for quite a while. But basically, yes, Tim, everything gets recycled very rapidly, and that special food chain is well known to the inhabitants of the sea. And I think, again, it brings us back to one of our most immense human problems, the treatment of our own wastes. And I think that when we get onto it and start following systems that link our back ends with our front ends through plants, we'll be going places. They've already achieved this. For the proposed trip to Mars, they've actually developed a system of filters because those guys on that 9-month outward trip, guys and girls, I hope, are going to have to recycle every tear, every eyelash, every bit of their body is going to be going through those filters and back to them. And a scientist once told me something. If people can remember one thing from what I say today, I'd like them to remember this. This really profound, simple thing, that as you and I stand today, within our bodies, we've got everything that we will ever want. So everything that we shed or slough off or excrete, if we can find the right pathways to bring it back to ourselves, then we've got a sustainable lifestyle. And it's within the bounds of our technology. A technology that can get us to the moon and back. I mean, that is incredible technology. Can't we find the technology to get stuff from our bodies back to our bodies through the plants? I'm sure we could. I just think we've never bothered to. We've never taken that trip. We thought it was easier just to stick it in the pipe and pump it out the sea.
I definitely agree. I know there's 10-15 years ago, a house in Sydney, Australia, all the waste from their toilet went into a pool, and it went down, trickled down through these different ponds, and they had different rushes and plants just to clean up everything. And the end result was, at the bottom end, the water was so clean that they could then put it through a filter and take it into the house and drink it again.
Well, I mean, that's what nature's doing in big picture. Every time it rains, it's just that we don't join into the big picture and we violate the big picture. And I'm just absolutely horrified that some of the best bathing beaches in Northland have been found to have high levels of bacteria. I can remember hearing stories about people in the islands that did their laundry up in wastes upstream from where they took their water. Everyone thought, oh, that's just primitive. Okay, it's primitive, but we're doing exactly that all the time. And it's absolutely disgusting to think that we go out to beaches in our highly developed cars to swim in an ocean that we've polluted. Just not good enough. The answers are so simple, but we're not taking measures to stop that. And the people trying to run sewage treatment plants are pulling their hair out because we've got systems that just are overloaded. And when it gets heavy rainfall, the stormwater systems are getting into the treatment plants, then they have to release it all into the harbours and rivers. And that's just not good enough, you know. We don't run passenger planes that way, so why can't we apply the same technology to our ordinary lives?
There's got to be a huge shift in consciousness. And speaking about this, science is slowly awakening to the concept that our planet and its tightly coupled life forms are one single living system, Gaia for short. What is your intuition or understanding of this greater organism, Wade?
Well, I really only started to fully understand it when I spent as much time up in the forests and in the, and up at the tops of rivers and wetlands as I'd spent under the sea. I've tried to balance my life. It would have been easy just to sort of stand on that one foot of exploring under the sea. It's been pretty hard work for Jan and I to get a thorough archive of all the plants in Northland, for example. But that was the challenge, just to become as familiar with those patterns of life on the land as we were in the sea. And then gradually we can start to understand what a huge, complex mechanism we're living in. It's a very exciting one. It's so positive. There are so many wonderful stories going on. One, for example, you know how on our offshore islands we're accustomed to think that's where all the seabirds roost, the petrels, the mutton birds and things. But that's not true. Those are where they roost now because we've brought so many pests to New Zealand that they can't nest on the mainland. But in recent years, scientists working up in the mountains, in the high areas of our country, have found that even found colonies of petrels on the west coast that are still living up in the mountains and in Kaikoura. But all through the spine of New Zealand, we used to have seabirds roosting, and they were nature's little top dressers. They took nutrients from the sea and excreted them up on the high points of all the catchments so that the phosphates and nitrogen from their waste were coming down and providing the forest with nutrients from the sea. So there was a complete cycle going on from the land to the sea, from the sea to the land. Every time we have a lightning storm, those flashes of lightning create nitrogen and other important nutrients which rain down on the soil in a very, very small quantity, but they're doing it all the time. This is the sort of system that I've come to understand that we live in. And once you see something really good, you want to be part of it, not stand alone.
I definitely agree. Wade, interspecies communication. And could you just tell us a little story of a dolphin experience? Because these beings are one of the most playful on the planet.
Well, Jen and I have been trying to understand more about dolphins ever since I had an incredible experience in the huge sea cave at the Poor Nights when I first met dolphins way back in the early 70s. In those days, divers didn't have anything to do with dolphins. They ignored us, and we ignored them. But that day, something really magic happened, which I described in my books, and it set us trying to answer them because they did things that we'd never experienced from any other animals. Well, it has reached the point, which I've also described in one of my four dolphin books, where we met dolphins down in the estuary at Fitianga. We lived with them on it. We had our catamaran moored there. And one particular dolphin that I called Rompal, after the great French flute player, Jean-Pierre Rompal, that dolphin established a connection with us through underwater microphone speaker, which was just like talking to you on the telephone. But it took over. We started initiating the sounds and it was mimicking us. But at one point, after the several visits and several days with it, it sort of sized up the situation, turned the whole thing around until it would come underneath the boat. We would see a gulp of bubbles, was like the telephone ringing. We would blow a gulp of bubbles back with a piece of plastic pipe. Gotcha. Then be a pause, and then we would hear a really complex sound, a sound being made on our wavelength, not the normal dolphin wavelength. It was made an adaptation to us. And then we would try not just to mimic it, but to take the sound and transmute it in such a way it says, yes, got your message, and here's our variation of it, which is a bit like what a couple of really good jazz men will do with a flute and a trumpet. So that was the level of communication that we experienced. But that sort of exchange, we thought, was all filmed. It went out on television. We thought that might sort of throw down the gauntlet for future scientific work along those lines. But unfortunately, the science of interspecies communication is at a very, very early stage yet. And we think we can study big brain animals by taking them out of the sea, putting them into cells or confinement tanks, and then experimenting on them. And of course, you know what human beings would do if you treated them like that.
So true. Oh, Wade, yes, well, we just trust that human beings awaken to the fact that this magnificent planet that we share is just so ready for us now to make the jump and communicate. And, of course, if you've seen the movie Avatar, you will get a profound understanding of how something may happen in the future.
Well, Tim, congratulations. I know how long you've been working on this. I met you a long time ago. And you've never given up. You've just carried on slogging away. And it's people like that all around the planet that give me hope that we are in a state of flux and we are moving. Sometimes it's hard to see the tide coming in, but it's moving.
Excellent. I thank you, Wade. Yes, it was 30 years ago and 10 days that you did an article on Project Interlocked for Paradise Rising, the magazine that we published way back then.
I still got it in my library.
Lovely.
Okay, Tim.
Thank you again, Wade.